do you do sadness? Are you afraid to grieve? We're learning about the benefits of crying, the benefits of grief, and what can come out of it this hour. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for the Joy Cardine Show. We're joined by Madison-based clinical psychologist Ron Johnson, and together with his fellow psychologist wife, Deb Brock, their new book is The Positive Power of Sadness, How Good Grief Prevents and Cures Anxiety, Depression, and Anger. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a tremendous privilege to be here.
Where does sadness come from?
It comes from love. It's quite this simple. I love something. I have it. I enjoy it. I lose it. I feel sad. So we call sadness a love problem. And it's essential to be able to be sad, because everything that I have, I lose. Everything. I lose ideas, I lose people, I lose property, I lose a direction. Maybe when I'm speaking right now, I forget what I'm saying, and I feel sad. And if I can feel sad, I can finish feeling sad. That's the key.
So why does sadness get a bad rap? Why does it have a negative connotation with it? Why do we avoid it?
We say sad is not bad, but sad seems bad, especially in this culture. We're not very good Americans. I wouldn't want to live in Iran or anywhere else, but we're not very good as Americans losing anything, losing property, losing wars, losing ideas, losing elections, and we always have excuses for it. So I think a lot of the difficulty is in America that we have not allowed ourselves to simply be sad.
We don't have room for sadness.
We don't. We get angry, we get afraid, we get depressed, we get upset, we get frustrated. All of that is essentially sadness. Sadness is the key to overcome all of that.
So what happens if we do make room, make time for sadness, to make time to grieve?
It ends. That's the key. Sadness ends. If I love something and lose it and feel sad, that sadness will run a course. Now, if it's a very large loss that I have, it might take hours. It might take days. Most of the time, it just takes seconds. If I don't let myself be sad, then I'm going to be angry, or depressed, or anxious, and then that will not end.
But on the other side of sadness, there is some resolution to that loss of that love. But what if we don't want to let go of that love?
Isn't that the beauty of it? I mean, of course we don't want to let go of it. We say, Deb and I say, you know, sadness is not easy. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable. And when I'm sad in the moment, I feel like I will be sad forever. It doesn't seem like this sadness is going to end. It just is terrible. And the only way to get there is to get familiar with it. It's like, oh, I've been here before. I've felt sad before. It feels awful. It's terrible. It seems like it's never going to end, but it ended before, so maybe it'll end this time.
What can children teach us about sadness?
Oh, my goodness. Can they ever teach us something? I was playing Monopoly with my favorite grandson, my only grandson, and I structured it a bit. He's 8 at the time, so he won the first one. He won, lost the second one, and when he lost, he just wept. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. Come over here. Put his head on my shoulder, and he cried, and he said, okay, I'm ready for the next game. Done. And isn't that the way sadness should be? Just feel it, finish it, and then go on. And children have that until, unfortunately, we teach them otherwise.
How do we lose that capacity to grieve?
Well, I'm afraid the culture does a lot to it. And this is a wonderful culture. I don't want to disparage American culture, but part of the difficulty in this wonderful culture is that we are not good at losing, like I said before. Parents, by and large, are not good at allowing their children to just grieve. I mean, what could I say to Gavin, my grandson? Could I say, well, no, kind of get over it. It's just a game. Well, if you're 8 years old, you just lost Monopoly. It's not just a game. It's a game. It's life. It's the whole thing of what's happening right now. And this is awful.
Or losing at a sporting event for
exactly.
A young child. Their little league game.
Yes. Like I will tell the men that I see, you know, I just see men in my practice. When's the last time when you were in an athletic event and you went into the shower room after you lose a game and you go, I really feel sad? Oh, no, you don't feel sad. You feel mad. You feel anxious. We'll get them the next time. He did this. He did that. The ref did this. The ref did that. So what would happen if I just felt sad? I just cried. I'd be out of the locker room in a big hurry. Who are you? Come on, get over it, guy. So the culture and well-meaning families, well-meaning parents that want to help their children recover, don't allow them to simply be sad. Now, here's what happens. If they allow them to be sad, then they will try to make it better. Oh, you'll get over it. Now, kids don't need that. They just need to love it, lose it, feel sad.
It brings me to thinking about tears and the act of crying. I recall covering Hurricane Katrina, and when the governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, going through hours and hours of working on the emergency right after Hurricane Katrina, she came to the podium and started crying.
Yes.
And you could hear people around saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't cry.
Exactly.
Well, what's going on? Why do we avoid crying?
Well, isn't it tragic that we avoid crying? I remember some time ago when I was in Spain, I was in a grocery store buying my loaf of bread or something. Somebody was in front of me, and I speak just enough Spanish to get in trouble, like, ¿Dónde está el baño? And that's it, right? So anyway, this man was telling the cashier a story, and he started to cry. And he kept talking, telling the story, took out his handkerchief, wiped his tears away, bought his loaf of bread, and walked out. I thought, that's remarkable. That would not happen in America. So I think the whole phenomenon of crying is certainly not masculine, right? Be a big boy. Don't cry. Get over it. You don't have to cry. I think I cry every day. In fact, it's a rare time that I don't cry. I just love too many things. And I lose things every day. I have an idea that I lose. I have a person that I lose. I'm working with a patient, and I don't do well, or I hear a sad story. So for me, it's very, very familiar. But for most people, it's not. Sadness is depression. It's not.
We're talking right now with Ron Johnson. He's a clinical psychologist at Midlands Psychological Associates here in Madison, co-author of the new book, The Positive Power of Sadness, How Good Grief Prevents and Cures Anxiety, Depression, and Anger. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. When was the last time you allowed yourself to grieve? Do you think crying makes you more vulnerable? Do you try to avoid crying, or do you let the tears flow? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Ron, let's go back to what happens in your body when you feel sadness. What happens to your body that causes us to react with sadness?
Oh, that's a tremendously important question. And I think we all know what happens of when people feel sad or when they feel moved. What do they do with their hand? Their hands go immediately to their chest. So something is happening in that person's chest. And what is that thing that is happening? Well, the heart is beating more. Mm. That's what's happening. And I am breathing more or deeper. That's what's happening. So
blood pressure changes.
Yes, blood pressure changes. And it is a dramatic and an extremely important phenomenon that's happening in the body. And the brain is saying something is going on here. We got to pump blood down here. We got to take care of what this is. We're going to have to breathe more. And so natural sadness comes with deep breathing.
And then what happens? Does the body remember that? What is causing that trauma? What happens next?
You just, without knowing it, perhaps, quoted a very important book, which is called The Body Remembers, or other books similar to that, like The Body Reveals. And in fact, the body does retain trauma. And the way it retains trauma is to repress emotion. So, for instance, if I'm in a war and I am shooting the bad guys, when I say that, I'm thinking about a patient of mine that actually did this, came back from Iraq. He said, I'm a bad person. Why are you a bad person? Well, because I was in Iraq. What happened? Well, I was shooting the bad guys, and the bad guys turned out to be a 10-year-old boy. I come back here. I have a 10-year-old boy. I'm a bad person. No, you're not a bad person. When you were there, you could not feel. You could not feel sad. You could not feel angry. You certainly couldn't feel happy. You couldn't even feel afraid. You couldn't feel anything. So he pushed that down. And then, of course, later, and that's what PTSD is, essentially. I can't feel what I feel at the time.
So he's essentially numb.
So he's numb. But those feelings don't go away.
Okay.
Just as you said, they go into the body, and the body retains those, primarily retains those in the chest. It depends on somebody's biology. Some people actually have certain inclinations to where their retention of feelings are. Some people feel it in their hands. Some people have headaches. Some people have colitis and other sorts of physiological reactions. But there's always a reaction to any emotion. And if you repress it, it will become physical.
And that perhaps is what leads to the PTSD, the anxiety, the depression, the excessive anger?
Yes, especially the anger. And let's look at anger. Anger is this. That's the subtitle of the book,
yeah.
The Cure of Anger and Anxiety. What anger is I lost something in the past, and I think that I can change the past by being angry. If I'm just angry enough, the past will change. So we jokingly say anger is delusional.
That's absurd.
It is. It's absurd. Why should I be angry? I mean, I lost my Monopoly game, or I lost money, or I lost my wife, or I lost my child, God forbid. And if I'm just angry enough at somebody, at God, at whoever, then I'll change the past. No, I won't. I will just stay angry. And I will not be able to grieve. I will not be able to finish that. And that's the key word in our understanding, is finishing the loss that I had.
So how do you help people grieve? How do you set them on the path to say, you have got to start acknowledging the sadness?
We say you have to back up from it. So if the phenomenon, if you will, the symptom is anger, we say, okay, anger is the third thing that you felt. What do you mean? Well, you're driving on the Beltline, and some, let's say, idiot, maybe some other word comes to mind, drives in front of you, slams the brakes on, and you are immediately angry. You're not immediately angry. What happened? Well, you're driving along. You had an intention to go someplace, and somebody stopped in front of you, and you were hurt. That's the key. You were hurt. A half a second later, you were afraid. A half a second later, you were angry. But you raced by hurt. You raced by fear, and then you were right into the anger, as if that's going to change it. It's not going to change it. You lost something. Well, it wasn't something terribly important. You lost your direction. You lost a few minutes, but you did lose something. So what we try to do with people is, when you're angry, you have been hurt. When you're hurt, you need to be sad. So when you're angry, you back it up. How was I hurt? What did I love before I was hurt? And sometimes that's the struggle. What did I really love here?
So you're slowing down the emotions.
Slowing down
the
emotions. Exactly. Slowing down the emotion. And you get to the place when you realize that when I'm angry, I have been hurt. When I have been hurt, I have loved something. I have lost something.
We're exploring the benefits of sadness this hour with clinical psychologist Ron Johnson. His practice here in Madison is Midlands Psychological Associates. The new book is titled The Positive Power of Sadness, and you can join in this discussion about grief at 800-642-1234. When was the last time you allowed yourself to grieve? Do you think crying makes you more vulnerable or less vulnerable? Do you try to avoid crying, or do you let the tears flow? Join in 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Joy Cardine Show. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer Kent in for Joy. We're exploring sadness this hour and the positive influences that grieving can have on our mental health. We have a pair of clinical psychologists here in the studio, Ron Johnson and Deb Brock. They say to trust sadness as a wise mentor and companion, that sadness is proof that we are human. Have you come to treat sadness in your own life in a certain way? What questions do you have about sadness and how to grieve? Join in with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Deb, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming in as well.
You're welcome, and thank you for allowing my tardiness.
That's okay.
I apologize.
Why did you say now is the time to write this book on sadness? Why do we need this book on sadness?
We need this book on sadness because, as we've said in the book, we think there's an epidemic. We have so many people who come in that are so overburdened with depression and anxiety that it seems to be the norm rather than the exception. So we'd like to see a reversal of that. We'd like to see our population, our culture, our humanity find a way to regain the natural balance of joy and sadness. We're overburdened with unnecessary depression that is a result of not following true sadness.
Let's take a call now. Susan in Monona. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks. Your first caller may have touched on this while I was asking my question, but not quite. A little over 3 years ago, I suffered 2 deaths in the family rapidly in succession, and I could not properly grieve for either of them as I normally do, because the first one, as soon as it was over, I was involved in helping with hospice and taking care of the other person that was dying, and then she died, and then I had both of them tangled up, and ever since then, I have been terrified to let it totally go, and I can feel it. It's a huge knot in my chest, and I'm just afraid if I ever do let all that pain out at once, I may just break. I don't know, and I would like to know how to take care of this safely, but on my own. I don't want to go to a clinic or anything like that.
Well, thank you for calling, and I'm very sorry for your very large grief. It is large. To do this on your own requires a lot of bravery to begin with. It requires that you trust what you feel when you feel it, and that you allow yourself to incrementally, if you must, take what comes to you and feel it and know that you are okay at the end, even though it doesn't feel like you are. It requires, in addition to your courage, it requires a lot of truth. Because in sadness, there are so many pieces. There is the sadness of the loss. There is the anger and the disappointment. There is the potential thought of what better could I have done, or guilt. And so you have to be able to be honest as well as courageous to do this on your own. I encourage you to take your time to use whatever resources you have, friends, books, prayer, meditation, physical activity, and give yourself lots of options to take this as it comes to you.
And, you know, in Susan's case, 2 losses very quickly in succession, the various emotions can get all intertwined, as she mentioned. Sorting through, compartmentalizing, or do you just take it all at once? And
you do a little bit of both, actually. Okay. You take what comes to you as you can recognize it. Ron and I are very accustomed to encouraging clients and friends and family to be aware of what they feel. And if you can trust what you feel in the moment, it is evolutional. It takes you to the next place. But if you try to organize it, if you try to compartmentalize it and make things happen a certain way, that's when you get bungled up. But if you can be aware of what you feel, as you feel it, you can move through it, and then you can come to the next piece.
Ron, you mentioned in the book that we all experience daily grief, and you mentioned crying a little bit every day. You refer to it as the little sads. Can you explain what those are and give us some examples?
Sure. I felt one about 20 minutes ago when Deb wasn't here.
Me too.
Well, and that's what that is, you know. I love Deb. I love her being here. I love doing work together. I love this opportunity of talking to folks. And I felt sad that she wasn't here. Now, should I feel angry at her or at the traffic or at God or something else? What good would that do? So that's a little sad. I don't feel sad right now, but I did. Why did I feel sad? Well, because I loved things. I loved her. I loved this opportunity. I loved being able to talk. So that's a little sad and very, very common.
How can we take more opportunities each day for these little sad moments, these little sads?
Back to awareness. I'm on bumper-to-bumper traffic, and it's like, I'm not going to make it. And I found myself tapping my fingers and saying, come on, come on. And I thought, no, we're actually going to be talking about sadness. I let myself be aware. This is sad. I'm not on time. It just comes from practice, dare we say.
And it happens every day.
Every day.
Every day. If you read about it or somebody else has... every day we have these little sads. We have these little disappointments. I'm a little bit late. I can't remember a word. I'm afraid about this. I'm writing something. I can't, you know, I'm with a patient in my profession, or I'm a plumber, and I have the 3/4 inch instead of the 1/2 inch, and I am angry. No, I'm just sad. So those are the little sads. You grasp those little sads, you'll be able to do the big sads.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for calling in. Let's now go to Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I'm calling is that I also, like the last caller, am having a hard time feeling sadness. But my problem is chronic. I've probably gone 15 years at a time without crying. And I want to be able to feel sad, and I am practicing more awareness and getting a little better at it. But I sense that perhaps what has made me so sad, or originally made me sad, was before I was verbal, because I can't remember much at all of my childhood. And so I am in therapy. I have been in therapy in the past. And I feel like we're going in that direction. But I'm just wondering if you have any advice for additional things I can do to try to access and let that sadness out. There are times, and I'll just mention this, sometimes I just feel numb. I don't really feel the sadness. There have been times when I've felt so much like I'm going to cry that I have this really painful lump in my throat.
Mm. One of the things that I would recommend for you, and I do this pretty much every hour in my office with my patients or clients, is finding a way to befriend your sadness rather than to think, what's wrong with me that I can't cry, or why won't my tears come? If you listen to those words I just used, there's a little bit of irritation indicated there. Befriend the sadness. Be patient with the sadness. Tell it you know it's been there a long time. It has a good purpose for you. You don't yet understand it, and that you're going to wait for it. You will be surprised if you can ally your emotion rather than combat it. It will be on your side, as it were, and you will experience more of a camaraderie with it.
Ron, do you have anything to add?
Well, I have a thought, Chris, and my thought is that you're a thinker. You're an analytical person. You're looking at data. You're a person that values justice and truth. If those things are true, that's a tremendous strength of personality. That's not a weakness. But the limitation of that, because my wife happens to share that same limitation, crying and sadness is hard because you want to think through it, and you can't think through sorrow.
Mm. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to call in. Let's now go to Ricardo in Racine. Hi, Ricardo.
Good morning. I'm wondering a little bit about the relationship between depression and sadness. Say you're losing a good friend, and you're really kind of depressed about it. Are you almost saying you should feel sad because sad is easier to work with than depression? What is the relationship between these two, and how does one handle this relationship?
That's exactly what I would say, Ricardo. I would say that you love him and that you're losing him. And you may lose him forever. You may lose him for a minute. You may lose him for a year. But the problem here is that you love him. Well, that's a nice problem to have. That's not depression. Depression has symptoms. The symptoms are sleep disturbance, energy disturbance, appetite disturbance, too much, not enough, or erratic. That's not sadness. Sadness is I love something, I lose it, I feel sad, I get over it.
You're saying you should look at a problem in a sad relationship rather than being depressed about it then?
Yes, exactly. Because when you look at it from a sadness perspective, you're realizing, I love him, I am losing him, I feel sad, just that, and then that will end, and then you will find a way to cope with the loss or to adjust to it after that.
Deb, relationship loss, divorces, deaths can be really challenging. Talk about the different type of relationship loss we may experience through life and how that can shape us.
Oh, that is so important. Thank you. Relationships begin in the womb, as our previous caller noted. Whether we're conscious of them or not, relationships are a part of all phases of life. So in the earliest relationships, if we do not have a sense of safety and a connection, then we sense a loss, even though we can't conceptualize it. As we mature and grow, then, if that is not somehow remedied, other losses attach to that. And it's, in my opinion, like a magnet. So losses just get bigger and stronger, and our sense of control or managing those become less and less. And so then as an adult, let's say, we enter into a marriage or a partnership, and we don't feel safe with that person, or they don't seem to respect us, whatever the condition might be, all of those previous losses start to tumble into the current relationship without us really being aware of it. And then that's where the devastation comes in. We think, okay, I can deal with this individual and the differences that we have, but all of those previous losses are entangled in it, so it becomes insurmountable and too difficult. A lot of relationships fail simply because it's not about the relationship, but all the losses previous to that have not been completed or finished.
There's a major backstory.
There's a backstory, absolutely.
But a lot of ways we control depression, control anger, control PTSD is by medicating. And you're saying, let's talk through this and let's really get through the sadness and then see where we're at?
Well, medication is an important piece because it should serve as a bridge, a crutch perhaps, that gets us temporarily through a terrible crisis or something that really has overpowered our sense of stability. Unfortunately, we think, in our culture in particular, that we depend on medication as a life process, as a sustenance, instead of just an intermediary. We would like to see people work, take the courage, take the arduous path of feeling through, being honest with what has happened in their life, dealing with what has happened by doing the sadness rather than just tolerating it vis-a-vis the medications.
And being able to mask it, if
you
will.
To mask it, absolutely. Yeah. Good word.
There are, last count, 125 million Americans on psychotropic medication. That's two-fifths of Americans. Something's really wrong with that picture, right? And God love them that we have these medications for people. But to that extent, we think that's the first order of business. We think the first order of business ought to be sadness.
Wait, excuse
me. Go ahead.
It's as if we assume we have to be sick to get well, instead of we are well and sometimes we get sick. We think, well, life is just terrible and everything's depressing and maybe I'll have a glimpse of joy here and there, instead of life is an equal balance of joy and sadness, give and take, have and lose.
Let's take another call now. KJ in Green Bay. Hi, KJ.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a veteran with PTSD, and I tell you the best thing I ever did was going to the vet center. And actually started talking about my experiences and how they made me feel. And I can tell you about slowing down the emotion once I started realizing what my physical triggers were, that absolutely changed my life. I mean, that's a separate comment, but really what I want to talk about is I've been around alpha males for a lot of my life. And I think we lie to ourselves about what masculinity is, because if you look at the quote-unquote alpha, the most alpha of males in our culture, you think about professional athletes, high-achieving athletes, and at the end of the season when they win a championship, what's the very first thing that these quote-unquote alpha of alpha males do? They cry. Okay, passion is a trait in high achievers, males included. And if you don't have passion, you can't achieve like that. And I think we lie to ourselves about crying is not, you can't have that and be masculine at the same time. And I would say as a human, you can't feel and experience things at a very high level without having passion. You know, the Latin root of passion is to suffer. And so once you win and you suffer through things as a team, there's this release. Either we made it, we survived, or we won, or something. But there's this release, and you let yourself go. And so I don't view that as not being masculine.
Well, KJ, thank you so much for your call. And Ron, what would you like to add?
Well, the first thing I think actually feel, KJ, is thank you very much. I'm actually, it's odd because we're talking about crying, and I'm moved by your sacrifice of time and effort and tragedy that you have seen. So I'm sorry for that, and I'm glad that you have found a way to recover from it. I couldn't agree more. I have little or no addition to what he just said. It's wonderful. He found it, and he felt it, and he finished it.
Let's take another call now. Rachel in Racine. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My mom had breast cancer 3 times, and the last time it was terminal. And she was given 2 years, and she ended up living 9. But, you know, she had 5 kids, and she was always that realist slash pessimist. And about 2 years into that last 9, she had sort of a come-to-Jesus moment where she just decided that she was going to see the glasses half full. You know, we were all grieving the fact that we were losing her, and she, you know, for 9 years was grieving the fact that she was going to lose us. And her change wasn't just temporary. I mean, she had slides and slide backs, but, you know, she became a positive person, which was amazing, and it her attitude towards her death changed all of us.
In what way, Rachel, may I ask? How did you change?
Well, I became a more positive person, and I'm a single mom of 2 daughters, so that was very helpful for me and my daughters. And, you know, once some of the things that we learn almost every day, we encounter the 3 of us girls encounter something that we use her death as, you know, as the, we use some lesson from her death. You know, my girls are in their teens and starting off in relationships, and we talk about, you know, if you love hard, you're going to grieve hard. So deciding, you know, how much are you going to invest in these friends, say? Are you, you know, if they're good friends, are you going to go all in? Because going all in means you're going to hurt more on the back end. You know, you've got to understand that. But also, you know, trust your emotions and just, you know that you have to go through pain to get to the other side.
Deb?
You know, and it's,
well, thank you so much. I think maybe you might come to work for us.
Well, it takes years with therapy and
yes,
friends.
It takes a lot of work, and your story, as sad as it started out, is a good indication and a confirmation that if you grieve hard, you will love more. And the way that we have said this is you find what you feel it, and you finish it. then when grief is finished, you find love in a greater capacity, in a more clear way. And your story is a good proof of that. Thank you so much.
We're learning how to process negative emotions and make them work to our benefit this hour with our guests, clinical psychologists Ron Johnson and Deb Brock. Their new book is The Positive Power of Sadness, and their psychology practice is here in Madison. How have you dealt with sadness in your life? Join in, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break, perhaps hear from you as we look at the power of sadness. We're looking at sadness, loss, grief, and why it's all good for our mental state with a pair of psychologists, Ron Johnson and Deb Brock. Their new book is The Positive Power of Sadness. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. When was the last time you cried? How did you feel about crying? How do you grieve? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Ron, the last caller was talking about grieving, but also trying to teach grief and sadness to teenage daughters. What can parents do to help children grieve and to teach sadness in the correct way to their own children?
The first thing that came to mind when I heard about the teenage daughters was a little joke that we have in our practice, and that is that we don't like to use diagnoses like schizophrenia and depression, anxiety. We have to for insurance purposes, but by and large, we think a 13-year-old girl is a diagnosis. Or we would say a 15-year-old boy is a diagnosis, right? These are times of adolescent times of very, very important times of emotional experience. And what happens during those times is that I should go through a breadth of experiences. I should feel a breadth of feelings. I should feel sad. I should feel afraid. I should feel excited. I should feel disappointed. I should feel occasionally angry. If we have an opportunity to have all of those feelings during the adolescent times in particular, we get a grasp of it. Sadly, most people don't get through that. What happens, unfortunately, with girls is that they get good at what we might say is a kind of sadness, which is usually relational. What boys get good at, if we use that word, is they get good at being angry, and then they go in two different directions. Women, unfortunately, towards anxiety, men towards anger, both of them towards depression, if you will, in the long run. So if the answer to your question is, how are we teaching it?
Yeah.
It should start early. It should start in childhood. It should start particularly in the ages between infancy and school years. These are the ages 2, 3, 4, 5, where a child has then bridged from a time where he or she has got pretty much everything that they want to a time where they don't get much of what they want because they want so much more. So they need to be sad. They need to be angry. And the more they're allowed to be sad and to be angry, and by the way, not get what they want, the better they are and the better they learn how to feel that I have something, I love it, I lose it, I feel sad, I get over it.
Yes. Some of the things that I do with my clients, I see a number of women who have been dealing with divorces or losses and deaths and cancers, etc. What do I do with my kids? That question comes up all the time. One of the things that I do, especially if they've not had the privilege that Ron just spoke of, growing up with the knowing of how to do feelings, is to demonstrate it with confidence for the parent, for the adult to just say, without much disclosure, I'm feeling sad today. It's okay to feel sad, but it's a hard way to make the day go through.
Hmm.
Or it's hard to do my work sometimes when I'm sad, but sad is good. And children will sense if or not the parent is safe and secure in what they emotionally feel. Then they will in turn be able to do their feelings more safely.
And the reverse of that, how should parents react to their child when their child is sad?
Pretty much the same way. Yes, you feel sad today. It's okay to be sad. Sometimes we are sad, and we'll be happy again, but right now we're just sad. Confirmation of what the feeling is so that they have no sense that something is wrong with me if I have a feeling. That's what we want to avoid.
Let's take another call now. Ruth in Altoona. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. And I appreciate the program. Thank you very much. One of the things that helped me through a real deep sadness was understanding, like, the grief process or a process of grief, and not the Kubler-Ross process of grief. Mm-hmm. But a man named Ken Moses out of the Chicago area had worked actually with Nazi camp survivors. And then he also had a child with disabilities. And I have a child with special needs. And when I realized that my daughter had special needs, it really was an adjustment, you know, an adjustment to say, okay, this is not the child I thought I would have. Mm-hmm. And to be able to embrace the child I have, who is really a delightful human being. Mm-hmm. But that process helped me when I could see that, when that came forward, when I could see that, and that it doesn't, you know, maybe ever fully, like, it could come back, like with another loss of some sort, maybe that emotion could come back. It's not the same. It's not as, there isn't that duration involved, but it really helped me when I was able to say, I did a lot of searching. There was sort of a shock at first. You know, there was some searching, some real numbness, which was the stage that really threw me for a loop.
And I'm going to jump in there, Ruth. Ron, there are different styles, so to speak, of grieving processes. Like, you know, different paths you can take for grieving.
There are. And there's so many ways of looking at this. For one thing, there's what we're talking about here is chronic loss. This wonderful caller has done remarkably well with her daughter, but every day she sees her daughter. Every day her daughter is to some degree impaired or challenged. Every day she sees that. Every day she has to feel sad. Every day she has to get over feeling sad. Mm-hmm. So in a situation like this, I think it's important to realize that I can feel sad one day, and then the next day I have the same situation, and I feel sad again. I have a patient that I see in the nursing home who has MS. Our daughter has MS. It's very close to me. And he can't move at all. And I have helped Brian. He's allowed me to use his name. That's his real name. To just feel sad every day for just a few minutes. Because, I can't move today. That's sad. Angry? Yeah, if you want to. Afraid? Yeah, maybe I'll get worse. Yeah, but what's really important here? What's really important is I love life. I love moving. Brian is much of a doer. Can't do anything. Can't be on the floor with his grandchildren. So every day he has to feel sad. And I think that's, in this situation, the key.
Another part I think is an important consideration is that even though grief is universal, grief is very individual. We are all different individuals. We have different personalities. We have backgrounds, support groups that create variables in how we do our particular grief process. So I appreciate this caller's acknowledgement that there is not just the Kubler-Ross, which was the initial understanding of how grief is done, but to take into account, who am I? What is my personality? What is my environmental support, so that we can take care of ourselves the best for us rather than compared to someone else.
Let's take another call now. Thank you, Ruth. Let's go to Deb now in Northern Illinois. Hi, Deb.
Hi, thanks so much for the program. And I was just calling for some particular advice as how to deal with when you're saying the little everyday sadnesses, which in and of themselves, they don't seem that large, but when taken together, you know, they're hurtful. And just like maybe rude shopkeepers, or I especially see like certain younger people treating older people with disrespect. And, you know, you say, did I seem rude or what have you? But it's more like a power narcissist type of thing. And how do you deal with those type of, you know, crazy individuals, like, I guess you could say?
Ron.
Deb, you got a love problem. You love people, you love truth, you love fairness, you love justice, and you see these things violated, and every time that happens, you feel sad.
Absolutely.
That's what that is. That's not something wrong with you. People are doing that, and they will do that, they will continue to do that, and I'm glad you're feeling sad, which is what you do when you see somebody rude. You feel sad. You can say, well, this is rude, or you can just realize, gee, I like to be nice to people, and being nice is a good thing to do. That's important. You're not doing it. That's sad.
What advice do you have for people who may struggle with finding the glimmer of hope, the happiness in their sadness?
You don't. That's the real key. That's a misunderstanding of this whole process. When I'm sad, in that moment, I do not have hope. I do not see the end of it. It feels like it will last forever. I think in the back of my mind that I will get through this. There will be something better. I'll recover from it. I remember that. I remember that I got through previous things. But when I lose something, in that moment, I am hopeless. I am helpless. I am hurt. And I just have to ride those waves.
Mm-hmm. Deb?
I just say yes. I think that's very true.
Yeah. Well, Deb, thank you so much for calling in. We have time for a quick another call. Anne in Racine. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Really enjoying this show. As a person who probably suffered from depression for many, many years of my life, I finally got tired of it and decided I'm going to take all the tips that other people have given me, mostly practicing gratitude, even in the dark times, and focusing on the moment, recognizing what's truly sad and what is a worry, and then telling my brain just to stop the worry.
Oh.
If I have to tell it 1,000 times a day, I tell it that.
I'm going to have Deb jump in here because we're short on time.
Okay, and good for you. Good for you to say no when the worry comes. You have evolved. You have really practiced this, obviously. And secondly, Anne, gratitude is one of the most important pieces of grief because, as we've already said, grief is proof of love, and there's nothing to be more grateful for. Mm. Good luck to you.
Ron, final thoughts, gratitude.
Gratitude.
We come full
circle. Deb and I are laughing because we have this little cabin up north, and the first thing we do when we open the door is we go over to the kitchen and turn on the little light over this little plaque that says gratitude. There's nothing more important than that. The more I appreciate, the more I will not resent, the more I won't be angry.
Well, Ron and Deb, thank you so much for coming on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this great opportunity and
our
pleasure.
Our tremendous pleasure.
Ron Johnson and Deb Brock, they are clinical psychologists here in Madison. They're co-authors of The Positive Power of Sadness, How Good Grief Prevents and Cures Anxiety, Depression, and Anger. The Joy Cardine Show is produced by Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for The Joy Cardine Show. We can continue this conversation about sadness on our Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Share your thoughts. Share your experiences. We'd love to read about them. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. We'll get perspectives on the top national and state news and what is making the week's developments. Hope you can join us for the conversations here on the Ideas Network.